Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Beef cattle supplies continue to shrink, and prices, while they have cooled off a little bit recently, they are still
historically high.
And they will continue to increase next year. This from USDA's Outlook chairman, Mark Jekanowski. He says the recent pullback in cattle prices comes partly from
concerns by packers about beef demand. Given these high prices and given some uncertainty about the economy, they're being pretty cautious in terms of their buying habits because, you know, there's concerns about, you know, whether consumers are going to maintain this strong demand. So that's put some recent pressure on prices.
But USDA says beef production is going to fall again next year, sending prices even higher. Gary Crawford, Washington.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, I think you have to look at this last week as potentially start of a rally in the cattle market.
Lee Schultz is an Iowa State livestock economist.
As bulls would kind of note, you know, there is potentially a fourth quarter rally. And this could be the beginning of it. Obviously, it's too early to really say that for sure. But, you know, we've really seen, both near month and further out months, considerable strength in fed cattle and feeder cattle. You know, we almost seen, fed cattle prices up, almost $5 per hundredweight if you look across the board. Now, I think a lot driving that, you point to a couple notable factors. Really, cash was pretty strong this last week. I think when you look at the South, prices were about $2 higher. I think they were kind of in that 183 range, up from 181 the prior week. Similarly, here in the North, you know, I think we've seen a strengthening of about $2 in price. And that, I think, is a big part of that. Now, I think related to that, we did see tighter slaughter numbers. So you're starting to see packers, I think, cut down on some of those slaughter levels. And I think that kind of helped from a supply standpoint. And then from an optimistic demand, we've seen the Federal Reserve last week cut interest rates by 50 basis points. That's about double what a typical cut is. And it's the first time we've seen those rates cut in about 4 years. And so certainly I think that provided some optimism when we think about consumers and, you know, with lower gas prices and what lower interest rates could do for consumers. I think that's certainly a bullish factor. Now, you know, a lot to monitor on the horizon, but I think that does provide a bit of optimism that may have trickled over into the cattle markets. Corn prices, I think, also were supportive as we've seen corn prices down for the week.
And for boxed beef?
You know, I would look for lows again here this week in that boxed beef cutout. You know, I think there is some potential as we get into October to maybe see some stabilizing in that boxed beef prices. And then kind of the ramp up to the holiday season, I think, provides certainly some potential there. Part of, you know, I think the lighter slaughter levels are kind of a direct result of this weakening cutout. So looking for support there by packers by cutting some of those slaughter levels.
And what did he see from the latest cattle on feed report?
This has been a cattle report that, you know, I haven't seen in a long time where we've really seen estimates came in darn close to pre-report expectations. Actually, if you look at on-feed numbers placed and marketed, they were all just a tenth of a percentage point off from those expectations. So, you know, from a high level, I wouldn't expect this to impact the markets all that much, given that, you know, those numbers were real close to where pre-report expectations were. Kind of a quick rundown. We did see on-feed numbers that were up 0.6% from a year ago. Pre-report had it up 0.7, so just slightly smaller. The placement number was down 1.4%. The pre-report had it down 1.5%. And then finally, the marketing's number there, you know, we did see that was 96% of a year ago, 96.4% of a year ago. And as you look at the pre-report, it was 96.5% of a year ago. So again, very close to where we were. There was one less slaughter day in August 2024 versus August 2023. And so I think that's part of the reason why we've seen lower placement and lower slaughter numbers. And so I think, you know, as you look at this, again, cattle on feed report, I wouldn't expect too many surprises in the market coming from this, given where the numbers came in.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I think the big one to think about up front is fencing.
Dr. Jake Thorne, a Texas A&M livestock specialist on differences between cattle and sheep.
Obviously, they're smaller animals. They have the potential to get through a barbed wire fence or a fence that's maybe a little bit leaky. Net wire fence is probably the best option for sheep. You can run them behind barb, a five-strand barb. Three-strand is probably a little too big of a gap. It can work, but they need to be motivated to stay home, essentially, if you may. I think from protection from weather, obviously, we need to be able to keep them, or they need to have the chance to stay dry, get behind a windbreak during our winters, and then also find some shade during the summer. But still, they're pretty resilient to some of the variable weather that we have here in Texas in the panhandle. They can withstand some pretty cold temps and warm temps during the summer. And so that's honestly, while it needs to be thought of by the owner and the shepherd, it's not a huge problem, or maybe not as big of a problem as people realize.
What can you expect in an integrated management program?
In all reality, they're going to spend more time with their own own species than, as opposed to probably mixing much. There's some management considerations, especially when it comes to supplemental feeding. If we get into a drought period or a time of the year when those females are reproducing and we need to provide a little bit of supplement, that needs to be a consideration by the owner. It's probably a time when if you put some cow cake out or some cubed range cubes out on the ground, the cows are going to run the sheep off of that. So that might be a time to split them up. But in all realities, they can absolutely run together for most of the time. I mentioned predators as being a problem. There have certainly been some stories that cows can provide at some level some protection of those sheep from coyotes. Now, I would not advise them to be the only form of predator control, but there have certainly been some instances where people observe sheep kind of seeking cows out in that pasture as a way to get away from coyotes.
Then there are the economics.
I think that one of the important things is that the sheep markets and the cattle markets aren't exactly in lockstep with one another. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But when you're a producer that's thinking about diversifying and being more robust in terms of your ag production, they make a good fit. Because oftentimes when lamb prices are high, that's not always the same time when calf prices are high or vice versa. Traditionally, sheep are produced or born in the spring months of the year. And so what that means is that most often the majority of them are sold during the summer or early fall. And because of traditional economic principles, supply and demand, usually prices are lower for lambs during those summer months or early fall months, and then they're higher during the winter and spring. And here in Texas, because we're not necessarily confined by our season, a really cold winter, I'm sure we get cold, but maybe not cold like our more northern states in the U.S., there's certainly the capability for us to produce lambs during the fall. And what that means is those lambs would be available or eligible to be sold in that January, February, March timeframe. And that's usually the low supply time of the year, usually the time of the year when prices are the highest. And so that's something that I'd really encourage producers to think about if they're getting into the sheep business. And that might also work well by not, spreading out your labor and your management if your cows aren't on that exact same schedule. You've got some sellable products, calves, lambs, at different times of the year, potentially. And so that can really help with economic and income streams.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
There are just a lot of things that we can't control, and unfortunately our the price of our inputs is one of them, and they, of course, through this inflation over the last few years, our input costs have gone up nearly 200%.
Growing a commodity means you're a price getter, not a price setter. Travis Myers is a cotton farmer from Texas.
That's just something that we can't control. And so that's why we rely on these safety nets through our government programs. And a perfect example of that is this year with cotton prices in the 60s, we're not even going to trigger a PLC payment that is supposed to help us through times like this. And so that's why we're in desperate need of a new farm bill with some higher reference prices and some more help for us in these disaster times.
Some regions can grow multiple crops, but he says in his area, just one. You lose that, it hits everyone.
Oh, it'll be terrible for our area. You know, I'm going to say at least 75% of the people in our part of this world are tied to agriculture in some way, you know, and whether that may be teaching our kids, you know, farmers' kids at the school. But, you know, we've got truck drivers here. We've got farm employees. We've got gen employees that will not have a job, you know, if this country can't grow cotton, you know, and keep everybody employed.
It's one thing to tell the story to neighbors, but he took it to Capitol Hill.
We got to go and spend 3 days in D.C., and we're very encouraged by our visit. You know, we coordinated this trip with a bunch of other ag producers and equipment dealers and bankers, and so we got to tell a really good story about how tough things are in the agriculture community right now, and I believe that they heard us. We're hearing some encouraging movements on the farm bill and on some disaster assistance packages that hopefully will be able to come through later on in the year. But I think they got to hear a lot of stories from all different commodity groups too. It wasn't just the cotton farmers up there crying for help. I mean, everybody through this inflation and input prices is suffering right now, no matter what you're growing.
Low commodity prices, high input prices. What's the biggest issue right now?
I believe, honestly, that trade policy is our biggest problem right now. We just don't seem to be getting any help at all from this administration right now. I guess they're concentrating on other things, but they're just not helping us out, you know, with our foreign markets. And, you know, the cotton is one of those that, you know, 80 to 90% of our cotton is all exported. So we just have to have that foreign market, and we're just kind of behind the eight ball on that right now. And so we're looking forward to some changes, however this election turns out, but we're just going to have some help in order to maintain this ability to grow and grow food and clothe the people in the United States and not have to depend on that all coming from foreign countries.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
That's not just John Bozeman saying that.
Dr. John Bozeman is ranking member of the Senate Ag Committee on trade.
When you look at the fact that we've run a massive trade deficit last year, we're running a massive trade deficit this year for agriculture, that's always been the bright spot. You know, we've always had a trade surplus and projected to have even bigger ag deficit next year. So this isn't just rhetoric. When you look at the facts, when you look at the numbers, all of that backs that up.
So is there a solution to the current ag trade deficit?
Well, it's really difficult because administrations actually set trade policy. The unions don't like trade. And as a result, this administration doesn't like trade. They talk a good game. They talk about doing this and that, but they've done absolutely nothing. And I'm not being partisan in that. As you said, I think a lot of my friends on the other side, and agriculture is not, it's not a Democrat and Republican thing. This is about regions of the country. Southern agriculture is different than the Midwest. You know, we talk to the Great Plains, they're different. California is different. The list goes on and on. And then the various commodities. Again, rice is different than cotton. Cotton's different than soybeans. Specialty crops, our livestock production, forestry, all of those things, getting all of that straight. Like I say, it is not a partisan type issue. But on the other hand, again, we need to do a much better job with the administration regarding trade and a lot of other things.
Can U.S. Ag regain market share?
No, we can get new business back in the door because, as I said, what the world wants right now are reliable trading partners. They want to trade with people that if you get mad at them, you're not going to cut them off of, whatever you're selling them or make things difficult. And the United States really does a good job of that. We've got the safest food supply of anyone, which, again, is a real plus. So they want our products. We can do this, but we need leadership from the administration. And then also, along with that, we need to supply the dollars that our organizations need so that they also can play a part in this and everybody work together to create new markets. But I've traveled a lot. They're begging us to step forward and do this, but we're just not there. And so tremendous opportunity. We just need to step up and take advantage of it.
But what needs to happen over the next few days?
We've got to fund the government, and we'll do that until December. But also, I think, really vitally, we've got to come up with some sort of package that helps the farmers right now. We could pass an ag bill tomorrow, and that would be great. That would provide protections for the coming fiscal year for agriculture, but it wouldn't help with the damage that's been done so far, with the fact that they're in such difficult situations because of commodity prices being so low and input costs being so high. So we need to help them there. And then very importantly, so they can go to the bank. And for the first time, we're hearing a lot from bankers. They're concerned about being able to loan the money that they need because of their bank examiners, because of the problems with it just not penciling out right now. But in order to make that happen, we need a farm bill. We need to get that passed as soon as possible. And I hope that we can all work together, get on board, and get that done during the lame duck before the end of the year.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Absolutely. Before I came to Congress, I was the co-owner of an engineering firm that did rural broadband projects.
Life before Congress for Representative Dusty Johnson of South Dakota.
We worked in about 40 states. We had about 400 customers, and they weren't the real, real big boys. They were the little rural telecommunications cooperatives, the little family-owned businesses. They'd be companies that would have 10 or 100 employees, but not 10,000. And those are the companies that have done a great job, particularly in the northern Great Plains, North Dakota and South Dakota. Most every one of their customers in a rural telecom area are already covered with fiber to the home. That's not the case elsewhere. And that's why, I mean, right now I'm the chairman of the subcommittee here in Congress that deals with rural broadband. And in the farm bill that we need to pass this year, I fought hard to make sure that we've got good funding, good programs, good rules around how do we get more rural broadband out there in the country. We're getting real close to getting the job done.
It's easy to get it in cities, but what about the last mile?
Well, it's money, money, money. You cannot put together any business case. I mean, nobody can make money serving rural broadband in the most rural parts of America. I mean, some of these line connections, I mean, it might cost $35,000 or $50,000 to build out to a particularly rural location. You're not going to make $50,000, not at $120 a month selling them broadband and some video. I mean, you might be making $10 a month from them. You might be making $120 a year. You might, I mean, in 10 years, you'd make $1,200. So you're never going to recoup that investment. And again, every 10 years, you're going to need to refresh the electronics in the home and in the central office. There is no business case to be made for broadband in our most rural areas. But we have a commitment to infrastructure in this country. We say we're going to be one country. We're going to have electricity everywhere. We're going to have telephone service everywhere. We've got interstates to go through rural areas too, because we're going to connect America. We've done that before. We're doing it again with rural broadband, and we're doing it much faster with rural broadband than we ever did it with rural electrification, or than we ever did it with rural dial tone.
That's solving the digital divide, but what about solving the healthcare crisis? Recent House Ways and Means Subcommittee hearing on investing in a healthy America. Dr. Mark Hyman.
The NIH spends $48.6 billion on research every year. $121 million is spent on nutrition research, a fraction of that, and yet it's the single biggest driver of all the diseases that all the institutes at the National Institute of Health are studying. And that needs to change in order to actually further study this problem. And I also think that we have an opportunity to really rethink our whole approach to treating disease, not just preventing it. I think prevention is important, but 5% of the population accounts for 50% of the costs in Medicare. And focusing on that group will create the best ROI, and I believe with CBO will create a potential scoring that allows this legislation to pass. I think it's essential we think about things a little bit differently. Prevention is important. We need to figure out how to do public health campaigns. We need public health measures that include, you know, nutrition, education of the public, addressing the food marketing. Countries, the UK just banned food marketing to kids, you know, from during the day, front of package labeling, help educate consumers like they do in most other countries in the world. They're far ahead of us in policy, and they're seeing the changes and benefits to their population. And yet, you know, we're not addressing these things in a serious way. And I think this, as I said in my testimony, is a national emergency, and it needs to be treated as that. I hope the next president will declare such an emergency and put a focus on it as we did for COVID. Whether we did it right or wrong, we had a focus on it, and we put resources to it, and we put efforts of the government behind it, and I think that's the kind of effort it's going to require.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
This week's topic is the 7% rule of body condition scoring cows.
Dr. Mark Johnson is an Oklahoma State University beef breeding specialist. He's also the host of Oklahoma State's Sun Ups Cow Calf Corner.
Now, we know body condition scoring is an important management tool, particularly at this time of year. If we think about spring calving herds, as we get into the time of the year, we're going to wean calves, probably conduct pregnancy checks on our cow herd. A good productive cow is most likely going to be at her thinnest body condition score at this time of the year when we wean. She'll regain some flesh and condition as we go through the fall months and she dries up, but our goal is to have cows at a body condition score of 5 to 5.5 by the onset of calving season, and to have our bred heifers in a body condition score of about 6 at the beginning of the next calving season. We know those body condition scores are going to give cows the body energy reserves so that they can turn around and get rebred 80 to 85 days after calving. So how does the 7% rule of body condition scoring affect us this time of year? Typically, in a commercial cow-calf operation, the most convenient time of the year to capture a weight on cows would be when we conduct pregnancy exams. Maybe the same day that we wean, maybe a different time, but in the normal annual management cycle of a cow-calf operation, that would be one day of the year. We're probably going to run cows through a chute and potentially capture a weight. If we evaluate the cows at this time and we identify that we need to put some body condition on them by the beginning of the next calving season, it is a really good time of the year to evaluate this because our cows are slicked off. They are about the middle part or middle trimester of pregnancy. It's the simplest time of the year from a standpoint of being accurate in our evaluation of body condition scores, not to have a lot of hair, a lot of mud, a lot of pregnancy that confuses the whole body condition scoring system. And so, I encourage producers to take a look at evaluating those body condition scores this time of year when cows are slicked off. And if you actually identify cows that look a little too thin, it's easy to identify a target weight to get to relative to the 7% rule of body condition scoring. If we look at a cow today that weighs 1,000 pounds, she's in a body condition score 4, and we want to get that cow to a body condition score 5, we need to put 7% of that 1,000 pounds on her and know that at about 1070, she's going to achieve another body condition score. It works on the flip side of this too. If we're looking at cows that got ample body condition on them right now, we know they could lose about 7% of their weight to drop one body condition score. And so, often an effective management tool is to think about a target weight. If we need to manage and feed cows accordingly going through the fall months here, if we capture a weight now and we think about the equivalent of one body condition score being about 7% of that weight we're seeing, we can put 7% more on them and arrive at a target weight that we want to get them to by the beginning of the next calving season. It'll pay dividends to have them at that goal body condition score in terms of that breed back and that reproductive performance we see in the cow herd whenever it comes time to turn out bulls or begin AI breeding next spring.
Dr. Mark Johnson is the host of Cow-Calf Corner, a segment in each week's Sunup program produced by Oklahoma State. More online at sunup.okstate.edu. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Working lands, our nation's farmlands and forests, are key to U.S. natural resource conservation efforts. To that end,
most of the action around climate smart agriculture and forestry really is on the mitigation side. How can agriculture contribute to efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions even while we maintain our ability to produce food and to remain economically viable?
USDA Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation Robert Bonney at the recent AgriPulse Ag Outlook Forum in Kansas City says even as growers expand conservation practices as part of their operations, there is need for USDA and all stakeholders in climate smart efforts to
recognize that the approach matters,
meaning one that is voluntary and incentive-based, one that conserves resources while providing revenue sources for farm and forest landowners. Because as the undersecretary believes,
we have to keep folks in business so we can do conservation.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.